All right. I've been thinking about this all week. There's a pattern that keeps showing up when someone inside a government agency or institution decides to report misconduct. And the pattern isn't about the evidence, it's about what happens to the person holding it.
Right, and that's exactly the thing that gets overlooked. Everyone assumes the system responds to the evidence, but what we actually see, documented across multiple legal frameworks, is that the institution often responds to the person first.
So walk me through what you mean by that. Because on the surface, a whistleblower reports something, fabrication, falsification, serious misconduct, and the expectation is that the institution investigates the claim.
That's the expectation, yes. And the Office of Research Integrity is explicit. Covered institutions are supposed to make diligent efforts to protect the positions and reputations of people who make good faith allegations. That's the stated obligation, but the operative word is supposed to.
So what actually triggers the shift? What makes an institution flip from investigate the claim to neutralize the claimant?
That's the core of what we're calling the liability conversion framework. The moment an institution calculates that addressing the misconduct costs more, reputationally, legally, financially, than discrediting the person who reported it, the target shifts. The evidence doesn't disappear. The person carrying it does.
So it's a cost-benefit calculation dressed up as institutional self-defense.
Exactly. And it operates on what you could call a zero-sum survival bias. The institution frames its own stability as incompatible with the whistleblower's credibility. One of them has to lose, and the institution has far more resources to make sure it isn't them.
Now, the early warning signs, for someone listening who might be wondering how this escalation actually looks in practice, what does the initial phase look like?
The first moves are rarely dramatic. It starts with procedural friction, a demotion, a punitive transfer, reduced responsibilities. The Council of Europe's documentation lists dismissal, suspension, wage reductions, harassment, and discriminatory treatment as documented forms. These aren't random, they're calibrated to signal. Your position here is now precarious.
And that's before any public defamation even enters the picture.
Right, and here's the key idea. Retaliation doesn't have to be completed harm to be retaliation. European Union rules are clear that even a credible threat of adverse action or an act that may cause unjustified detriment qualifies. So the institution can apply pressure without ever pulling a visible trigger.
Wait, it can also reach people around the whistleblower, not just the person themselves.
That's one of the more chilling documented features. Indirect retaliation can affect facilitators, colleagues, even relatives who have a work-related connection to the same employer. So the isolation isn't just professional, it's social. The message spreads outward. Being associated with this person carries risk.
So not just destroying the messenger, surrounding the messenger with silence.
Precisely. And the Office of Research Integrity specifically recognizes that retaliation can take the form of a civil defamation lawsuit. That's a named mechanism. The institution uses legal process itself as a weapon, filing suit to drain resources, damage reputation, and occupy the whistleblower's attention entirely.
Which raises the question of why this strategy works so reliably. Why is destroying the messenger often more cost-effective than addressing the underlying misconduct?
For example, consider what it takes to defend a defamation suit versus what it takes to investigate and remediate institutional fraud. The defamation route keeps the conversation about the person's motives, their credibility, their mental state, never about the original evidence. And the EU guidance explicitly names defamation proceedings, copyright claims, and secrecy claims as legal actions that may be weaponized against reporting persons outside the work-related context.
So the legal system becomes part of the mechanism, not a check on it.
Which is why both the EU framework and the Council of Europe recommend that a protected report should be usable as a defense in those very proceedings. The idea is to close the loop if someone weaponizes law against a whistleblower. The whistleblower can point back to the protected disclosure as a shield.
The takeaway from all of this, for our listener, is that liability conversion isn't a conspiracy theory. It's a documented institutional reflex, and the legal frameworks we've been describing exist precisely because this reflex is predictable enough to legislate against.
A person can receive whistleblower protection even when the reported threat doesn't ultimately materialize, provided they had reasonable grounds to believe the report was accurate. Protection isn't contingent on being right. It's contingent on acting in good faith. And that distinction matters enormously when the institution's first move is to attack the person's judgment rather than engage the evidence.